From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with drama critic Richard Gilman. His book, Faith, Sex, and Mystery, is a memoir about how he became a lapsed Jewish atheist Catholic. Also today, actor and film director Robert Townsend talks about Hollywood's stereotyped view of blacks. He directed and stars in the movie Hollywood Shuffle. He plays a struggling black actor looking for a part that's not a pimp or an escaped slave. Book critic John Leonard reviews Life and Death in Shanghai, a first-hand account of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back at the Orioles, one of the first black doo-wop groups to have crossover hits. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is theater and literary critic Richard Gilman. He's written a memoir about a side of life even many of his friends didn't know about, his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near-total state of disbelief. His memoir is titled Faith, Sex, Mystery. He says that he came into the church because of death and left it because of sex. Gilman converted to Catholicism in 1953 at the age of 28. 8 years later, he left the church, concluding it held no place for him, either sexually or intellectually. Although it has been 25 years since his deconversion, the issues that brought him into the church remain important to him. Richard Gilman has been a theater critic for Commonweal, the Catholic literary magazine, and Newsweek. He's past president of PEN, the Society of Writers, and is now a professor at the Yale School of Drama. His earlier books include The Making of Modern Drama, Decadence, and The Confusion of Realms. Richard Gilman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Did your initial attraction to religion baffle many of your secular friends?
No, not really. I had grown up, or at least from college on, had as most of my friends, people who were looking for something, questing, you know. And as I say in the book, I at one time or another was a Freudian, a Marxist, a D.H. Laurentian, you know, all kinds of things. And while religion was not, to be a formally a member of a religion, a formal believer was not a the in thing at the time. It didn't baffle anybody among the people I knew. What would have baffled most of them had they known later, and some of course did, was that I would do anything serious about it. You know, to be interested in religion is one thing; to become religious is another.
You were born into Judaism. When you became religious, how come you didn't become a religious Jew?
Well, I, as I say in the book, I had a perfunctory Jewish upbringing. You know, I went to Hebrew school and I was bar mitzvahed. And went to synagogue on the holy days. My mother and father were, I would say, perfunctory, nominal Jews. My grandparents were quite religious. But I didn't grow up in a religious home at all, and I never really learned anything about Judaism as a religion. Essentially, what it was a, at the one sense, a tribal reality. And I never was interested in it as a religious thing, and it slipped away from me very quickly once I was bar mitzvah and reached 14, 15, at which point I declared myself a very adamant atheist, which was partly a political stance, you know, at the time. But for the next 10 years or so, I investigated passionately every kind of system of belief. I was looking for something.
What did you find in Catholicism that you didn't find in other places?
Well, I found truth, what I considered to be truth. There is a very strange, well, not so strange, something has happened in questions of intellect and questions of value. Well, probably for the last couple of hundred years, which is that the truth of a proposition or of an idea isn't the crucial thing. The relevance of it is. And I was convinced through a rather lengthy and arduous process of thought and experience, as I describe in the book, that Catholic claims to be the repository of truth in the very basic sense were justified. I joined the church essentially not for sentimental reasons, certainly not for emotional reasons, essentially for on the basis of the fact that once I saw something as true, it seemed to me that I had to act on it. It took me a long time, as you remember from the book.
One of the things you write about very candidly in the book is your mixed feelings about certain sexual fantasies that you had, a very kind of slight masochistic type of fantasy that you had. Did you experience guilt about that, and
sure.
did that feed into your
sure.
wanting to enter the church?
I had, when I was growing up, when I was in my teens and early 20s and so forth, the world was rather different. Society was rather quite different. There are things that I felt guilty about and ashamed of that would scarcely make anyone ashamed or guilty today. You know, I had certain fetishes. I had certain tastes in, you know, in women. I admired strong, aggressive women. The kind of thing which certainly didn't hurt anybody. I felt guilty essentially because I grew up in an era when a great many things were taboo, and were not discussed, and were not permitted. And my father was a particular Puritan, as I touch on in the book. I had a very difficult time reconciling my sexual nature with the church's commandments. But that difficulty, I think, would have been the same whatever my sexual proclivities were. For example, I have gotten a number of letters from gay people, mostly gay men, one or two women also, who've read my book and who tell me that they're very grateful that someone has come out and candidly talked about sexual difficulties in relation to moral commandments or religious commandments. And while my particular situation was not theirs, they appreciated that sort of thing in my book. And that meant a lot to me.
Well, actually, sex had a lot to do with your leaving the church, but
exactly.
I want to come back to that
sure.
in a few minutes.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit more about your entry into the church.
Yeah.
Now, you were brought up in a Jewish household. It
yes.
wasn't a very religious Jewish
no.
household, but still, I mean, certainly it was a secular Jewish household.
Yes.
Many Jews are really uncomfortable around Christian religious practices.
Sure.
And I wonder what it was like for you to enter church for the first time
yes.
as a converted Catholic, mm. knowing what your parents would have thought.
Oh, sure. Oh, it was very difficult. I grew up with, I would guess, sharing a very widespread feeling of suspicion, fear, hatred, you know, of what my family called and, you know, in that my milieu was called the goy or the Gentile or, you know, the others. And as I talk again in the book, there were certain images that were very oppressive to me. The church itself, physical churches, nuns, for example, that whom I thought were sort of black apparitions from some dark area, priests, certain words that troubled me greatly. Oh, I had to overcome a great deal before I could actually, you know, go into the church. As I say in the book, too, what was very fortunate for me, I think, was that when I actually was baptized, I was out in Colorado Springs, and I started to go to a very small Mexican-American church, a very simple church, in which almost all the parishioners were Mexican-Americans and generally a lot of old women. Some couple of quite gentle priests. The whole feeling there was far more, far simpler and far less involved with the kinds of images and practices that I had, that had disturbed me before. So I sort of slipped in a better way than it might have been elsewhere. But I did have a great deal to overcome in my mind. I there's a line, I think, in the book where I talk about the presences that sat or moved in my mind, images, words. To which I had very reflexive responses of coming from a very early age.
Theater and literary critic Richard Gilman is my guest. He's written a memoir titled Faith, Sex, Mystery. Converts are in a unique position. Usually people in a religion share a cultural past with the people mm-hmm. who they come to pray with. But when you're a convert, you don't have that shared
right.
past. You're brand new
That's exactly
to this tradition.
Right.
Did you feel like you were
I felt,
sticking out and
yes,
different?
Yes, I felt Well, there were two kinds of feelings I had. One was that I had slipped in and it didn't matter where I came from. Because when I did become a Catholic, I almost immediately went to the extreme left, if you want to call it that, of Catholicism. Politically, socially, I started to write for a magazine on the left. I got associated with things like Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker, that kind of thing. A liberal Catholicism, you can call it that, which was a big help to me because I had always had that feeling about the church that a lot of people have, liberals, had that the church stood for reaction, fascism, you know, that sort of thing. There were times when I felt like an interloper. I felt I didn't belong. Sure, and I had that sense of not having shared in the background. But part of that was that I didn't share in the ethnic background because it's not easy to separate ethnic realities from religious ones. For example, growing up in an Italian family or a Polish family or an Irish family. So that I saw it as a question of both ethnic difference and religious difference. But at the peak of my belief, and that, it lasted, for some years, which is to say when I was believing fervently and practicing ardently, the spiritual realities transcended any sense of social dislocation.
Do you remember the first time you accepted communion and what that felt like?
Yes, I described it. I always had difficulty with communion. The question of the wafer being the body and blood of Christ, the whole phenomenon of transubstantiation. I had difficulty with it. I knew it was essential, crucial element of Catholic practice. And I remember watching the people go before I took communion. I used to go to church and sit in the back and watch, before I was actually baptized. And I would watch them and I would see, and they looked very peculiar as though they were all, many of them looked like they were sleepwalking and others looked like they had just experienced some very grave event. And I found it very difficult to think that I could do that. Anyway, I finally went up to the altar. It was in this church, little church in Colorado Springs. And opened my mouth and accepted the wafer and must have been in a kind of catatonia because I don't remember how I felt. I remember walking back to my seat in the pew and swallowing the wafer and wondering what I had done. I never quite could accept the thing. I accepted the practice. I could never quite get over the sense of the mystery, and I suppose it eventually, of course, is a mystery of what it was that it did. I know that there was a gap between my rational perception of the thing, taking communion and my actual experience of it.
During the first part of your stay in the church as a converted Catholic, you were feeling a lot from it. When you were getting the most from it,
yes.
what was it you were getting?
Well, I was getting a sense of priorities. I was getting a sense of being, well, I described it as being carried by updrafts of grace, of being sustained by a reality beyond myself, greater than myself, all those kinds of things. I felt that my will was supported. I could will effectively. I could act the way I thought I should act. It's the only period of my life, and this lasted several years, in which I felt that my whole being, my psychic, my intellectual, my emotional selves were cohesive and moving together, and that didn't last, but it was there for a while.
You felt that integrated, but were you able to tell your parents that you converted?
I never told my parents, and I explain again in the book why. My parents were not Orthodox Jews. They were not very religious Jews, but they were very psychologically Jewish. And I didn't have a good relation with my father. But apart from that, I felt that there was no point in my telling them. They would not have understood. They would have felt offended. They would have felt affronted. They would have just about exploded or fainted or something, and I felt that there was not much point in telling them. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, in the primary virtue of what that fashionable word, sincerity. We should be sincere, you know. Sincerity hides a lot of spiritual pride. It hides a lot of arrogance and so on. I saw no reason for hurting them, and I saw no gain or value in that kind of sincerity in telling them. They suspected. They knew, especially when I started writing for a Catholic magazine called Jubilee and then later Commonwealth.
A clue.
Yeah, they must have had some. I told them that these magazines did employ some non-Catholic writers, but I think they were so happy that I finally had a job, because I had not had a job. I was drifting through my 20s as what I used to call an intellectual bum or hobo. And so they were so pleased that I finally had a job that I think they would have swallowed anything. But in any case, I didn't tell them.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. My guest is Richard Gilman. He's a drama and literary critic. We're talking about the subject of his new memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Richard Gilman is my guest. We're discussing his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery, about his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near total state of unbelief. Richard Gilman is a professor at the Yale School of Drama. Let's talk about your falling out with the religion. I think one of the things you found most frustrating was the church's view of sex and contending with your own sexual desires. Could you, for instance, accept masturbation as a sin? This was not a concept you were used to.
I could accept it as a sin because it had been presented to me in a secular way as a kind of crime. In other words, something you were not supposed to do.
Sure, because a lot of children were always told you'd either get pimples
or something really terrible would happen to me. My mother was filled with threats that something really awful would happen to me. I accepted it as a sin, but I had trouble with it even there. I had trouble always reconciling the sexual aspects, the aspects of what are gathered under the rubric, the title lust, sins of the flesh, you know, lust. I think that obviously sexual sins are for many Catholics and much of the church as an institution and for many religions the most serious, the prime sin, and I don't think so. I've never thought so. I think that sexual sins can, for example, formal sexual sins, sins of lust, can have in them love, they can have in them generosity, they can have in them compassion and a sense of humanity, a sense of mortality and so on. In other words, they can have virtues in them that other sins like gluttony or avarice or cruelty, you know, do not have. And the church's emphasis, which is what I encountered, I think it has changed, I would imagine, certainly in the United States, changed for the better. It's not nearly as monolithic as it once was. Hence the American church's quarrel with the Vatican over things like abortion, you know, that sort of thing. The greatest trouble I had was to deal with what I thought of as the inflexibility, the abstract condemnation of certain acts, which I felt needed to be seen in a more supple, a more complex way, and a more compassionate way.
We keep quoting St. Augustine as saying, "God, send me chastity, but not yet."
Yes.
But I get the feeling that in your own life, you didn't want to have to totally sacrifice the flesh in order to find spirituality.
Exactly. I thought I should, in a way, not sacrifice it completely, but for example, I was married much of that time, and I had problems with my wife. I had, on an occasion, I would go outside marriage, and, you know, in other words, commit what was be called technically class adultery. I felt that my particular sexuality would be even more difficult for the church to accommodate. I remember thinking of Jesus sitting up on his throne in heaven and rolling his eyes in shock and horror at my particular fantasies, which, of course, is an absurd notion. But as I said before, I think no matter what my sexuality was, it would have come into conflict with, you know, with the church. And that's the kind of response I've gotten from a lot of people who've written me, you know, about the book, that they experienced much of the same thing.
Well, I think for a lot of people who are religious or slightly religious, the conflict comes up between sexuality and religion, mm-hmm. or between some other belief or passion that they have in religion. And the question becomes, do you stay and fight off your impulses, or do you accept your impulses and leave the religious institution?
Yes, of course, that's the question. There was another aspect of my quarrel or battle with the church, and that was what I do call my ambition or my ambitiousness. When I came in the church, I felt a great relief from the burden of selfness, you know, burden of ambition, the burden of competitiveness, the feeling that I want to make a place for myself in the world. I was very ambitious, and I had quite a time, I was very content to sort of labor anonymously. Not worry about making a name for myself. And then gradually, as I got into my 30s, and I had literary ambitions and had them, which I'd squelched, which I'd simply suppressed in myself. And I know it was a kind of foolish dichotomy that I or opposition that I erected there. I was taking the admonition to be humble and, you know, and to efface myself quite literally. And even though I consciously knew and was told by people I knew at the time that there was nothing irreligious or sinful in developing my talents, you know, and gaining a reputation, I felt guilty over that. And finally, the ambition, the suppressed literary desires broke through, and I began to feel that this humility that I'd had before was pretty false.
Well, you even talk about a self-aggrandizing kind of humility.
Yeah. Now, you see, I still think this is something that touches on a great many things. You pointed out at the beginning of the book. You quoted the idea that I do not have any real belief today. I still have some. I have a faint, more than faint. It's there. Some kind of, for example, I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. I don't know how or what. But one thing that I got from the church, from the essence of the church, the best part of the church, was a sense of something to combat the fierce, cannibalistic almost, you know, competitiveness of our time, which is gaining all the time, the aggression, the greed, the putting of the self first, which we phenomena we see all around us, you know, and it seems to grow all the time. I remember feeling that only through this kind of principle of at least partial self-effacement or generosity, a sense of giving to others, could you combat that. What seemed to be the tide of the times, you know, the tremendous individualism, the dog-eat-dog, the man is a wolf to man, and all of that, which I felt then and see even more strongly now.
So you believe in God in a kind of, but that's where the mystery comes in. It's not, you're
yes.
not part of an organized religion
no,
right now.
No, I don't go to church. I don't know if I ever will go back. I didn't write the book in order to go back, you know. And yet I find stirrings of various kinds.
Well, I want to ask you about art, too. I mean, because one of the things you've really struggled with throughout most of your adult life are questions of religion. You've also struggled with questions of art, and I'm sure there's some connection there for you. Because let me remind our listeners that you're a literary critic, you're a drama critic, you've been writing almost all of your adult life, and you were a passionate reader even when you were a child.
Well, I think it's true to say that for me, for a long time, and to a certain extent now, not nearly as strongly, art was a kind of religion. And I think that was true and has been true for a lot of people. I think less now, but it certainly was true. It began to be true probably a couple of hundred years ago. And I think it developed in the 19th century. And in our time, and particularly with what we call modernism, the sense of art as a way of belief, a way of dealing with experience, literature particularly, but the other arts too, was this kind of substitute religion or a pseudo or quasi-religious experience. Though I think that there is a strong connection of a very fundamentally good kind between art and religion, I think, because both deal with the impalpable, both deal with realms of reality beyond the immediately provable, beyond the scientific, beyond the ascertainable. There's a remark that I'm very fond of quoting. I always quote it to my students by the French writer Charles Peguy, who described what he called the bourgeois mind, and by bourgeois he didn't mean necessarily any economic level, a kind of mind, he said, that always and inevitably prefers the visible to the invisible. And I think that art, in a way, and religion in its way, offers the invisible as a kind of alternative to the palpable, the known, the visible.
Well, you know, in that connection between art and religion, many religions use art in a way to for as part of the religious experience through hymns and songs and paintings and iconography
and cathedrals,
literature.
And there was, of course, a time in human history in which art and religion were very closely united, fused almost.
You know, I want to ask you one last thing. You almost apologize to your readers at the end of your memoir for giving them nothing definitive, no calls to order, no models for behavior, no moral resting place. But it seems to me that finally that's what your experience is about. It's about continually questing for some kind of answers to big questions, but not finding pat answers.
Right. Well, I think that came... I had the sense that and perhaps I was silly to worry about this, but I have a feeling that in books of this kind, this the broad genre, people are looking for some kind of answer, and of course they get very cheap ones, you know, from lots of people. Some kind of thing. Now I'm this, and now I'm that, and by implication, this is what you should be, and this is what you might do, and so forth. I came out with no conclusion. I am still, as I said, peddling in midair. I don't. I have no answers. And it's interesting that a number of letters that I've gotten from people have told me that that's fine, it's all right, they didn't want me to, you know, that it would have been false if I'd come out with some denouement, you know, some final conclusion and saying, this is it, this is the truth. I don't know.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Richard Gilman. He's a drama and literary critic, and he's written a memoir of his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he now calls a near total state of unbelief. It's titled Faith, Sex, Mystery, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. He's a professor at the Yale School of Drama. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with novelist John Nichols. He wrote the Malagra-Beanfield War, which Robert Redford has just made into a movie, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, actor and director Robert Townsend talks about his new movie, Hollywood Shuffle. It's a satiric look at how Hollywood casts black actors as pimps, junkies, muggers, and jive talkers. It's based on Townsend's own experiences. Also today, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the Orioles, one of the first black doo-wop groups to achieve mainstream success. Book critic John Leonard reviews Life and Death in Shanghai, Nian Cheng's account of her 7-year imprisonment during the Chinese Cultural Revolution, and we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Now we have the news. This is Fresh Air, and now it's time for some rock and roll history. In 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first black man to play Major League Baseball. A year later, the Orioles, a black singing group from Baltimore, helped integrate a largely white American institution, the pop charts. Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward has the story.
Courage. It's a word you don't hear much around rock and roll these days. I don't think it's anybody's fault, just a sign that the music isn't as scary or radical as it once was. Because while the music today has problems to overcome, censorship to name one, American society isn't at all like it was when rock and roll was young. Consider the color barrier. In 1948, the freedom that black people had enjoyed in this country working at defense jobs during the war and earning good pay had left its mark. It was still too early to say that things were changing, but they were. Still, it took people of courage to make that change, and two pioneers of rock and roll named Erlington Tillman and Deborah Chesler were definitely courageous people. Tillman was a 23-year-old black man who used the name Sonny Till when he performed with his singing group, the Vibronaires. Chesler was white, Jewish, and a salesgirl in a Baltimore department store and was not quite out of her teens. Since most rock and roll historians pay more attention to the stars than to the people behind the scenes, I can't tell you how Deborah Chesler got hooked up with the Vibronaires or what it was about them that got her excited enough to devote herself to them the way that she did, but I do know a couple of things. The first thing Chesler did was to convince the group to change its name to the Orioles. The next thing she did was to drive them to New York, where she got them a spot on the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scouts program. They lost, but they got to play at the mecca of black entertainment, Harlem's Apollo Theater. She also wrote them a bunch of songs, and the first one, It's Too Soon to Know, came out on a tiny label called It's a Natural.
Does she love me? It's too soon to know. Can I believe her when she tells me so? Is she fooling? Is it all a game? Am I the buyer or just another player? Oh, she may be just acting and playing the part. If she don't love me, let her tell me so. I can't hold her if she wants to go. Though I'll cry.
In its first week out, it sold 86,000 copies, making the Orioles the first modern black harmony group to enter the pop charts, not just what was then called the Harlem Hit Parade. Black and white artists tried recording versions of the song, but the Orioles triumphed. The next year, they were back with another of Chesler's songs, Tell Me So. And in 1953, they scored their biggest hit with Crying in the Chapel, a song Elvis Presley later recorded.
You saw me crying in the chapel. The tears I shed were tears of joy.
But by then, the Orioles had made their biggest contribution to American popular music. They'd accustomed pop fans to black harmony group singing and opened the doors for not only their fellow bird groups, the Swallows, the Flamingos, the Robins, but for even rougher, stronger, more gospel-like singing. Of course, they were perfectly capable of that themselves, as this 1951 recording, Waiting, makes clear.
Waiting. Yes, against some.
Crazier did Sonny Till shout rock and roll during that sax solo. Sonny Till died in 1981, and although I've tried, I can't find out what happened to Deborah Chesler. They didn't break pop music's color barrier alone, of course, but what they did do certainly took a lot of courage.
Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Yes, I could die of ready, but I must keep on.
Listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Townsend. He's the producer, director, co-author, and star of the movie Hollywood Shuffle. The film takes a satiric look at how Hollywood treats black actors. Townsend had been working as a stand-up comedian and actor, but rarely had the chance to try out for good parts. Even after supporting roles in A Soldier's Story, Streets of Fire, and American Flyers, Townsend was being sent on auditions for the parts generally available to black male actors, pimps, street punks, drug dealers. I asked Robert Townsend what led him to make a comedy about his experiences.
I didn't know how to speak up at that point because every actor in town was in there auditioning, and I said, wait, this is a terrible script. Maybe it's me. And then I started thinking about it, and I would go in and read a script, and I go, this is terrible. And then the next guy this is the greatest pimp I've ever read, you know. And I think it had to do with, you know, I began back then to begin to look and see something was wrong.
What kind of roles were you auditioning for that you're talking about?
Stoolies on TV shows, you know, the guys that always have the information that the cops always talk to, Huggy Bear, Turkey Neck, you know, they always have those weird names. So those are the kind of parts I would audition for.
Are you convincing in that kind of role?
I'm a good actor. I could pull it off. Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a good actor. You know, I wouldn't mind doing a street character if I could play a lawyer next week and a doctor the week after that, or a detective like Sam Ace or something like that.
But the problem is there aren't many roles like that to play.
Right. They always write the stereotypical, you know, just jive street.
The character in your movie is directed to be blacker while he's playing a part or auditioning for a part. Were you ever directed to be more black?
Oh, yeah, because, see, the way I talk, when you're considered black, you're supposed to talk like, well, yeah, baby, you know, I'm doing this interview and things with you. So that's the way I should talk. That's considered black. If I was saying like, oh, this is national radio, baby, that's black. But the way I'm talking now, then they say, well, you don't sound black. I mean, you could, you know, if I was just tuning in, I would say, is this a black person? I don't give you the key words. And so a lot of times they ask you to be black or because black is, you know, all the, you know, sitcoms of the 70s. And they say what? So that's considered black.
You had a lot of actors who you cast in your movie. Did they all have stories similar to yours about being cast in roles they didn't really want in the first place? Roles that were very stereotypical?
Yeah, I mean, everybody. I think one of the reasons the actors agreed to do the film was because they could identify with the movie. It was their story. A lot of actors, older actors, black actors, come up to me now and they say, thank you for telling our story and what we were all going through and is going on now, and, you know, you told. I mean, because it is the truth. I mean, you can look in the newspaper now, and the only film that's playing with black people in it is Hollywood Shuffle. And there's like 400 movies that come out of Hollywood every year. And this year, I will have the only film with more than three black people in it.
Now, you've also been in some TV commercials. For years, there were virtually no black actors in TV commercials, but now, especially in burger commercials and in soft drink commercials, there's a lot of black actors in it. Are there new stereotypes of blacks coming out through these commercials?
No, I think commercials, if anything, they show black people in a better light. I mean, in TV commercials, at least I had dignity in 60 seconds. I mean, I was a bank teller, I was a construction worker. I was a plumber. Just a regular guy hanging out at an office building, you know, waiting on a date. I mean, they have different, you know, commercials at least show life. You'll see a black family on a TV commercial. On TV shows, you never see that. You know, you'll see, like, for McDonald's, you'll see, it's time to go. Our family's on our way to McDonald's. Hey, Dad, you know, and they'll show, like, a loving family or Tide commercial. They, you know, show a family with a mother and father. Your average show on TV, it's always, I had to raise these kids on my own, and I'd never seen they daddy.
What are some of the movies you liked when you were growing up?
Wizard of Oz. My favorite film of all time is Here Comes Mr. Jordan with Robert Montgomery. That was one of my favorite films.
I love that film. That's the film about the boxer who's been reincarnated, basically, sent back down
right
to Earth.
Yeah, Claude Rains, Robert Montgomery, and Warren Beatty did the updated version with Buck Henry and James Mason. It's like, Joe, listen, Joe, you're not Pendleton, Joe. You can't stay in this body, Joe. You know, that was one of my favorite films.
As a teenager, did you like any of the exploitation films like Shaft and Superfly?
I love those movies because that was the first time we saw the black man get the girl. You know, I remember seeing the scene in Superfly when he made love in the bathtub, and it was like, I can't believe this. Because other than that, black people had played butlers, and it's like, you want your luggage, Mr. Jenkins? And that was the only role we played. And so when you saw Shaft, and he had a gun, and he slapped people around, and he fought for right, you know, it was like, great. We had never seen it. Because normally, the black actor was the buddy to the star. He never, you know, like, he never was the man. You know, he never was in charge and said, I'm fighting for right. and that's what I'm going to do here. You guys are bad, you know. And Shaft was that way, and Superfly was that way. I just think that they made more pimp movies than they made movies about, you know, black people from the regular walks of life. I think that's what messed everything up. There were too many negative role models. I mean, if they would have had a pimp movie and then a movie about a doctor, then a movie about a lawyer, and a movie about a guy who was in love, everything would have been fine. But it was just, you know, 90 pimp movies versus one sounder. You know, that was what the deal was.
You started as a comic, I think, before you became an actor, and you do great impressions. Did you do impressions a lot as a kid? Did you do impressions of teachers or movie stars, family?
Yeah, I did a lot of impressions. I used to cheat the phone company. I used to call because I didn't have money. And when I was, you know, going to the basketball court, I would call the fellas, and that's how I used my talent back then. I'd get on the phone and, "Hello, operator. I'm sorry. I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't reach this number." "Yes, operator. My name is Dr. John Wilson. Yes. Thank you for putting me through, operator. Thank you." "Yo, Willie, how you doing, man? Yeah, meet me at the gym, 4:30. So I would do different voices and characters as a kid.
Oh, that's great. Did that work, by the way?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you never knew who I was. I mean, because I'd get on the phone and I was like, "Hello, operator. My name's Paul Ogemeyer. I'm trying to reach, you know, Deborah Jenkins. That's right. You know, I just got it from Cheshire. I deposited a dime in the telephone. I can't get it back." So no one would never know who I was.
Why did you go into acting from being a comic?
Well, I wanted to be an actor first. I wanted to be a dramatic actor, and everybody would laugh at me. So I said, I should be a comedian.
Did they really laugh at you?
They really said I would do a dramatic scene, and people would laugh. And I was going, "Wait a minute, that was dramatic. That was drama." And people go, "No, you're funny, man. You're funny. No, that's funny." You know, and I said, "Let me be a comedian then."
I think part of the point of your movie was to try to get some more visibility for yourself and to get some better roles for yourself. Is it working?
Oh, yeah, it's working. I've just signed a deal with Warner Brothers, and they're going to let me write, direct, produce, and act in my next film. And so, yeah, I think that now people approach me differently because I've put out what I really felt I needed and wanted to do. And so now people are responding. They're saying, like, "Hey, you know, we can't bring talents and garbage scripts. We have to bring them something of quality."
Are you getting a lot of resumes and audition tapes now from black actors who figure you're going to be directing new movies with good parts and they want in?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I think I can't go out my house now without someone with a picture or a resume. Out here they had the Ira Aldridge Awards, which is an award show for young black up-and-coming actors and stuff in competition. And I was taking back my tuxedo, and the guy at the tuxedo place had a script. He knew I was coming in to bring my tuxedo in, and he had a script. I was like, "No. There is no escape for Robert Townsend right now, a man destined to get pictures and resumes for the rest of his life." So,
are you going to feel guilty if you can't give all these guys roles?
Well, I mean, I can't. I mean, really. I mean, and then plus I got 83 people in Hollywood Shuffle, and that's my immediate family, and so I'm responsible for them right now because it's not like, well, I'm in a good position now and let me work with, you know, all these other people. It's like, no, I'm going to continue to work with my friends.
Robert Townsend, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, too.
Robert Townsend's film is called Hollywood Shuffle. Here's an audition scene from the movie.
"Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies."
"Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting."
"Sure. Okay. Let me see. I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?"
"Thank you. Thank you.
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic."
"You be messing with the wrong dude, bro."
"Thank you.
It
was very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you like it?"
"Very much."
"I ain't be got no weapon."
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are you covering today? I know the Iran-Contra hearings adjourned today for at least 10 days.
Well, they did, Terry, and on this last day, Fawn Hall returned for a second day of testimony. Also, the chairman of the House committee ended this first stage of hearings with a summary, calling the testimony some of the most extraordinary ever. In East Berlin, there have been confrontations, the most violent in 10 years, between police police and rock fans. 3,000 East Berlin rock fans had crowded around the Berlin Wall to hear a rock concert going on in West Berlin. And finally, we have tips from our book reviewer, Alan Chews, on summer reading.
Thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Nian Shang is a native of China who spent most of the Chinese Cultural Revolution in prison. Up until that time, she'd been living a prosperous life in Shanghai. Chang is now 72 years old and lives in Washington, D.C. She's written a book about her imprisonment and her release. It's called Life and Death in Shanghai. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
I'm unaware of anything else in prison literature comparable to Life and Death in Shanghai. We've heard from the tortured and the brutalized, witnesses to Holocaust and poets of the Gulag. But we've never met anyone quite like Nian Cheng, an English-educated Chinese gentlewoman of the Shanghai upper middle class. At age 51, a widow, a mother, and a former employee of Shell Oil, Cheng was arrested at the very beginning of the Cultural Revolution in 1966. She was accused of having been a running dog of British imperialism, abused at struggle meetings, beaten by Red Guards, and held without trial in solitary confinement for 6.5 years, and she remembers every minute of it. Understand that Chang, except for her remarkable stubbornness and spirit, is not exactly likable, especially if you're a Chinese communist from the wrong side of the tracks. She is the embodiment of almost everything the revolution was supposed to abolish. With her fur coats and evening gowns, her white lacquered screens and Chopin nocturnes, her antique porcelain plates and rose quartz incense burners, her 4 bedrooms and 3 servants and bank accounts in Hong Kong and Singapore, and a Persian cat named Fluffy. The best she can say for Mao is that he was an evil genius, and the only book of his she ever liked was the one on guerrilla warfare. But she will quote him, as everybody during the Cultural Revolution was obliged to quote him, 3 times a day. One of these quotes is new and only semi-scrutable to me. The capitalist class, said Mao, is the skin. The intellectuals are the hair that grows on the skin. When the skin dies, there will be no hair. Chang saves her skin by driving her interrogators crazy. On the streets, the Red Guards smash windows, burn books, beat professors, and chop off the hair of women with permanent waves. It is adolescent rage and symbolic parricide and numerology. Inside Number 1 Detention House, the proletarian revolutionaries want from Cheng a confession that will somehow disgrace Chu Enlai, please the military, and appease the night mind and the bloodlusts of the Gang of Four. Cheng refuses to accommodate. She is guilty only of being herself. She won't apologize for that. She doesn't wheedle, nor is she cuddly. She nags and scolds. She seems less victimized than insulted. Part schoolmarm, part jailhouse lawyer, part Maggie Thatcher. She refuses even to imagine that she won't prevail. Her contempt is her prophylactic. Somehow she feels she's immune. I'm surprised they didn't just shoot her, but they were amateurs. After 6.5 years and a change in the party line, she is released and unrepentant. She will spend another 7 years in Shanghai, under a sort of privileged house arrest, until she can sneak her way to the United States. God knows, she tells us, how hard I tried to remain true to my country, but I failed utterly through no fault of my own. In this ferocious century, her feeling, her conviction of immunity is amazing. But then so is her book. She intimidated a revolution.
Our book critic John Leonard reviewed Life and Death in Shanghai. Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with Cynthia Payne. She was the madam of a London brothel that catered to older men. Her life is the basis of the new film, Personal Services. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new compact disc of Verdi's Don Carlo. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will recite the Pledge of Allegiance to see if you understand it any better than he does. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, research assistants from Seuss Bolin and Karen Murdrick. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.